So our first podcast was with Shaq. Our second podcast was with ESPN's Kirk Herbstreit. And now we welcome you to the third Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each month we talk to interesting people in the sports media community and get input into their jobs and how they see the role of sports journalists. We have a panel today, and it is an excellent panel. We have three former ESPNers now working and starring at other places. So this is our post-Empire trio. You can come up with whatever nicknames you want as we go along in a conversation. Bruce Feldman is in studio with us. He is the CBS.com senior college football columnist. He also appears on the CBS Sports Network. You can find his excellent work all the time on CBSSports.com. On the phone, we have Amy K. Nelson. She is now a senior correspondent for SB Nation and someone who will be appearing often on, I don't know if this is SB Nation's YouTube channels. Amy can explain this, or Amy often tweets about how she's going to be on YouTube all the time. She can explain to us exactly what that means. I'm not sure myself. And then we have Pat Forty, who is now with Yahoo Sports. He is their national college columnist. And I went online today. As his bio says, he is an award-winning writer, author, and commentator with 25 years experience in newspapers and online. I would recommend very highly, if you are on Twitter, to follow all of these guys. Amy K. Nelson is at AMYK Nelson. Pat Forty is at Yahoo 40, spelled as it sounds. Bruce Feldman is at B. Feldman CBS. And I will say that is a longer intro than I gave for these guys than I did for Shaq and Kirk Herbstreit. So you guys hopefully will live up to that. All right, well, we'll start with you, Amy K. Nelson.
Oh, geez.
On the phone. And I'm going to ask this of yourself, of Pat, and of Bruce, just so we could sort of establish where you are now and where you were. You are now at SB Nation. You were at ESPN for many years. Why the decision to leave ESPN?
Well, RD, I made the decision to leave ESPN because I sort of felt that I had spent 7 years there, entered the company at somewhat of a younger age, and this opportunity came on to join SB Nation. It was very entrepreneurial. It seemed sort of like a rare opportunity that I might not get again, and it really got me excited. And really, those were truly, genuinely the real sort of reasons or my main motivation for leaving. And I'm sure you'll probably have a follow-up, or you'll want to probe a little bit more and see if there's anything slightly even remotely nefarious about any other intentions of why I would want to leave ESPN. And I mean, I think really, you know, for me, I, like I said, I entered at a younger age. We, at ESPN, we had, and they still do have so much talent that I think sometimes it's a little hard to, unless you come in, you know, high profile senior guy, sometimes it's a little hard to fully make your mark. And I just felt like this is really the right time in my life to sort of make this move.
We will follow up on those larger themes, Amy. We'll go to Pat next. Yeah. And Pat, you know, as Amy said, you at ESPN were at the top of that place along with Bruce when it was thought of as when thinking of college football reporters. You obviously had a great presence on television. And then you made a move to Yahoo Sports, which I think many in the marketplace who maybe don't follow Yahoo Sports as close as they watch ESPN would be surprised at. Those of us in journalism know how great Yahoo is when it comes to news breaking and reporting. Their hires have been fantastic. But I think for the average layperson, maybe watching ESPN from the middle of the country, you used to seeing Pat Forty on television, they'd wonder, why did this guy leave a television place for a website? So what's the answer to that, Pat?
Yeah, you're right, Rich. I mean, there's a lot of friends that I have, non-media friends, who will ask very cautiously, is this a good thing for you? Like, i.e., did you get fired? And the answer is no. I had a very good offer to stay at ESPN. I had a great offer to leave, and I took it. Yahoo, as you mentioned, is, I think, the industry leader in investigative journalism, does a great job breaking news, is, you know, basically has a little bit different niche and a little different mission, a little different approach in a lot of ways. I'm really good friends with a lot of the writers there, have been for years. And this is something I thought strongly about going back to 2008 when I signed my last contract with ESPN. I remember being in Beijing at the Olympics and talking to Dave Morgan and Dan Wetzel and saying, man, you know, I really like the way you guys do things. And they're saying, well, we really like you. And it's like, huh, maybe one day we could work together. And I did talk to them in 2008. And, you know, it just didn't quite feel right then. I think I was a little bit afraid to leave the security of ESPN. And, you know, as things progressed over the 3 years after that, I think Yahoo became a more and more attractive entity. And I did 7 years at ESPN as well, like Amy did. And, you know, it was a great place to work, but it seemed like a long time. By the end of it, it felt like a long time. And so I was ready to try something else. And there was Yahoo with a great opportunity for me.
Bruce, your story is well known to people who listen to this podcast. I'm not going to ask you to go through that. It's been written about by myself, by the New York Times, by a million blogs. So I think in terms of this podcast, people aren't interested in rehashing your story. What is interesting, though, Bruce, is now that you're at CBS, I want to ask you about, and we'll get into this with Amy and Pat after you'll start it, about reporting and constrictions of reporting when it comes to reporting on places that have various rights deals or business connections. You've only been at CBS for a little bit, but what, in your opinion, is different about reporting on college football there than reporting on college football for ESPN?
Well, I don't want to speak for Pat or Amy on this, but just from my perspective, and I'd worked at ESPN for 17 years, and I felt like in the last few years, things had kind of changed or ramped up a little bit in kind of the operation, how it was and what went up the food chain and different things. And I can see from a lot of different examples just in the last couple of months, and obviously I've only been there since September 1st, but where a big story breaks, and at CBS Sports, I feel like we are very proactive and we're not sitting back and waiting because, you know, from where I was at ESPN before, I felt like you really had to wait until you were cleared to go into action or do something. And I use this as an example in the Penn State case. And I think Pat was down in Birmingham as well. We were at the Iron Bowl when that really story exploded or started to. And, you know, as it did, Dennis Dodd, who's a colleague of mine at CBS, we had ridden over to the game, and we discussed a lot about what had started to come out of Harrisburg, Sarah Ganim's work and some of the other stuff that they had done, and how do we go about this? And I think in the next, you know, I want to say within 48 hours, I mean, both Dennis and I had filed columns, and there was a lot of dialogue back and forth of before the story actually went on, before my column went online, before Dennis's column went online. But, you know, I felt like that was, and the ability to not, to be, I hate to use the word free, but the ability to be engaged in that story at that time and in different stories when it comes to breaking news and different things. Because if you're at ESPN and even you know something's about to happen and you find out somebody else reports it and it's out there, well, everybody else in the blogosphere and everybody else on Twitter has already acknowledged this story existed. And if you're at ESPN, until ESPN, if ESPN can't, you know, have their fingerprints on it, sometimes they'll just wait for AP or they'll wait for an actual a release from the school or from the, you know, whatever entity it is before, rather than, you know, acknowledge something that came before it. And so I felt like you were walking on eggshells a lot. And that was my perspective. Again, I don't want to speak for Amy or Pat on that, but a lot of that, you know, over time, you know, the last few years, especially, I've noticed it's really ramped up with Twitter because of the, you know, it's so everything's so much faster. Decisions have to be made faster. So that, for me, just getting to CBS has been very liberating.
Pat, I'll follow up with you first, and then we'll get to Amy. Bruce talks about this notion of, you know, he used the word walking on eggshells or sort of waiting for whether it was the AP or some other place. You know, you and Bruce, covered a lot of the same terrain. So when a big story would break at ESPN, how was it from your end? Did you feel restricted, whether it was restricted based on their business relationships or maybe restricted based on just their editorial philosophy when it came to certain stories?
Yeah, I would echo everything Bruce said about the Penn State situation. You know, and I won't go back through it because the similarities are striking, because I drove from Birmingham to Tuscaloosa with Dan Wetzel, and Wetzel, I think, wrote the first column anybody wrote on Penn State. Yeah. And in the car, we're like, yeah, I'm going to, all right, you go to State College, and boom. And I was there Monday morning, you know, and I was in Harrisburg at the Attorney General presentment, and then I'm in State College that afternoon, and there was nobody from ESPN at either place. And there's just a greater flexibility. There's a greater proactive mindset at Yahoo. There's a greater flexibility. Writers can make decisions more and be more a part of the decision making process. And that, you know, at ESPN, you run something up the food chain, and it can take forever for it to come back. And generally, I think the approach is to be cautious and conservative. And sometimes caution and conservatism is the right call, but sometimes it's not. I never felt like writers were given a whole lot of input into what the call was going to be. You know, there was a lot of email exchanges, not a lot of phone conversations, and basically, you know, things came down. They didn't go up. It didn't seem like a whole lot. And I think if you look, you know, in terms of manpower, ESPN can be wherever it wants, but they're very formatted in trying to cover the basics of what happens on the field, on the court, and do a good job of it. But sometimes that lack of flexibility to move around and do other stuff, I think, inhibits them to deal with breaking news, to deal with big picture stuff, to deal with controversial stuff. You know, I just think, you know, at Yahoo we had, shoot, they told me, you know, I was so used to the 40-yard dash must be done every single week on this day that when Penn State breaks and Dan Wetzel saying, you got to go to State College, I'm saying, but when am I going to do the dash? And he's like, screw the dash. Like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Screw the dash this week. This is bigger. So, you know, there's just I'm definitely feeling a much more liberated decision-making process.
Amy, I wonder where you weigh in on this, and you're an interesting case to me because, and this is my opinion, this is not anything you have told me or that I've gleaned from ever talking to you, but, you know, being part of ESPN's baseball coverage, there's a lot of sort of star people at the top, and it in my opinion, was very hard for someone like you, someone who I think is really good, really smart, to break through, you know, the only Kirkegin, Stark, Gammons, you know, fill in the blank, whoever else is covering baseball. So I wonder how you feel what Pat and Bruce were talking about, because not only would you have to maybe deal with some of the walls that exist, you might have talent walls to have to sort of run above, because there were people above you on the baseball beat who were clearly making more money than you and clearly had more, for lack of a better word, fame than you.
Yeah, you know, I can speak to, I guess, sort of all those things. I think the first thing that sort of resonates with me is I definitely had at times a sort of paralysis come over me when it came to breaking news and particularly regarding sort of the social media guidelines and all, you know, when those were sort of handed down, I guess, over the past few years, I became extremely paranoid. And Pat said this, sometimes this is good to use caution and to be conservative, and sometimes it's borderline absurd because, you know, you're just getting your ass beat by all the competitors. And I had definite fear for even retweeting someone else's information or trying to sort of spin it forward without making sure that our desk at least had put something out on ESPN.com first, and sometimes that would take forever. And you have no idea because, you know, you're in a vacuum. You're not in Bristol. You're not in the newsroom. You're not aware of all the conversations that are happening, like Pat said, above you and around you and God only knows where else. So that was, I think, sometimes frustrating, but I mean, I understood the genesis of it, and I believe it really did come from a good place, and ESPN has always felt this huge, enormous responsibility because of how massive it is, and I respect that, and I did respect it, but it didn't make it easy sometimes. As for sort of, you know, me being buried in the baseball beat, yeah, I mean, you know, I think, listen, they have great talent there. Buster's amazing. Timmy is amazing. You know, and they're more on the TV side at this stage. But, you know, I also was behind Jason Stark and Jerry Krasnick at .com. And, you know, I did a little bit, you know, the type of work I did was a little bit more enterprise, feature sort of oriented. I did do a lot of news breaking as well, but I was sort of a hybrid person there. So I think sometimes it was just really difficult for me to find an exact role. And I was sort of working more towards that, but, it's not like, you know, I knew there was going to be a clear opening anytime soon. I mean, those guys dominate what they do. And I just had to really work for every little inch I could get to get my opportunities.
Bruce, I want to ask you about television and being on television for a sports writer, because it's interesting to talk to you about this, and certainly Pat and Amy, I'll get their take as well, because you're doing a lot of television now for CBS Sports Network. And I've always, as someone who's written about this, I've always come at it from two ways. I understand the value of it, and I love the fact that sports writers are on television and get paid for it. I'll say that. I think it's fantastic. That said, the around-the-hornization of sports writers drives me through the roof. And we're on the 32nd floor taping this, or the 31st, and I would jump if there was a loop right now of Around the Horn just to not have to hear that. So the larger point is, I think what bothers me sometimes is when sports writers are portrayed almost clownishly. Now, you, Pat and Amy, I feel like avoided that for the most part, but, you know, I think for the listeners, they're going to find this interesting. How much pressure do you find to be on TV? Or maybe the better question is, how important is it for your own relevance to be on television? Not just to, you know, you are a writer, but you are now a multimedia platform player. How important is it for you to be on TV?
Important in this regard. I do think that the visibility you get from coaches and people who you cover seeing you, on some level, they will call you back faster. There's different level of rapport that comes after somebody sees you on a screen as opposed to reads you. And I don't know if that has so much to do with just a lot of people don't read as much or not. I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, I follow you on Twitter. And it kind of startles me, because you only usually hear from the people who are like sniping at you or whatever. But, you know, that level of recognition, I think, helps in doing the job. Now, you know, the around the hornization, I don't want to call it, you know, I think when you go on TV, you know, everyone's personalities are different. You know, the last, where it's hard, I think, for some people who come out of it like I did, just, you know, didn't grow up as a, going to be a broadcaster. It's like you're the information guy. So you're beholden to the information. And sometimes you will come out very flat, and you will not be dramatic. And the last thing I want to do is go on TV and be a jackass and just be completely pompous and screaming and have all these kinds of, you know, buffoon qualities about it. Now, I'm not saying when I go on there, you know, if I predict a score of a game, I could just as easily get it wrong. But I think you try to be true to who you are and to the viewer. And I think that why it's important is this whole thing, and I do, this part I did get from early on at ESPN in the last decade or so, was, you know, this whole aspect of build your brand.
Right.
And there is something to be said for that, which is you have to be active on Twitter. You have to, you know, as many ways as you can serve the viewer, the user, the whatever you want to call them, I think has been kind of fed into you. And if you're not, you know, look, Gary Smith, I think, is phenomenal. But there are very few people who can be, you know, exist in that world and not go outside the other level. And it is very seductive. I mean, there's a reason why some of these really, and I don't want to mention them by names, but there are some incredibly talented writers whose work as feature writers has gone downhill, and everybody knows it, except it's very seductive for them. They've done that. Now they want to be TV stars. It's seductive. There's more money there. And I also think, there's a lot of time it takes to go do TV. I mean, I have to be way more prepared. I make calls for TV now to coaches, as opposed to necessarily, you know, I can write about it and repurpose it maybe, but you don't want to go on TV and be underprepared. So I do think it's pretty time consuming, and eventually something is going to suffer. You won't be able to, you know, spend as much time working on a story or write as much because all the TV, and that has been, at least for me, has been an adjustment.
I'm going to move to Amy. I mean, Bruce isn't going to say it, but I certainly will. And a prime example of that is Rick Reilly, who, you know, again, was brilliant, I thought, at this magazine, and certainly personally was fantastic to me when I was a reporter, but has now gone on television because I think that sort of was important to his brand, and is simply just not as good on television as he is in print. That said, maybe that stuff doesn't matter when you're sort of set with a contract and they want to promote your brand. Amy, I want to ask you about television, but this is something that is unique to you on this podcast, and that's being a woman. And I wonder how often on television you would either hear from people, not from necessarily people at ESPN, but from people maybe who are on Twitter or whatever, about your looks-based performance. Because the thing that is always frustrating to me is just how, one, women are not really allowed to age gracefully on sports television, and B, so often when it's sideline reporters, whether this is Aaron Andrews or even in studio, Michelle Beadle, whoever, the first take on them is always about looks before performance. And that's something that you might have had to experience as opposed to Bruce and Pat.
I don't know. Maybe Bruce and Pat also experienced that. I can't really.
Well, both Bruce and Pat are handsome men, so maybe this is the wrong
example. They are. Well, you know, when I first entered this business, when I was 21 years old or 22, it was like the number one question that people would ask me: Are you going to do radio or television? Just because apparently I like looked okay enough to be on television, so therefore, you know, it was an automatic career path. And I actually was kind of offended by that. And you know, I'm a pretty raging feminist, so I actually in my mind said, you know what, screw that. I'm gonna write. I want to learn this business, and I want to do it the right way, and I want to prove to people that, you know, that I'm actually, you know, I have brains, because apparently some people think that I just should be on a sideline. This is really early in my career. And, you know, whatever. I mean, listen, yeah, of course, if I go on television and then I check my timeline, usually there's always some sort of remark about how I look, whether it's disgusting or apparently okay. But I don't know. I feel like it's just sort of par for the course, and I guess that's obviously a fairly sad commentary, but it's just something I just deal with.
Did you find more when you, let's say you were on something like Jim Rome is Burning, mm-hmm. where you would be on television for a full week, that mm-hmm. comments like that started getting more and more because you were seen over and over again?
Oh, yeah. Deadspin did a whole post on it, you know, about the obscene, vile sort of remarks I was getting on Twitter and how I didn't know what the hell I was talking about and really other lewd, horrible things that people wanted to do to me. I feel like there are sometimes other things to talk about, but I will say that when I did this investigative piece on the Toronto Blue Jays this summer, I have never received such incredible amount of misogynistic commentary or discourse in my life. It was really astounding. And I had some great colleagues of mine who kind of said some stuff on Twitter about it. And there was that woman, I believe the columnist for the Buffalo News, who had something very similar to her happen to her, and she wrote a column about it, and I thought that was great. You know, it's sad, it's pathetic, but it's just sort of like one of those things that we have to deal with in this industry, no matter how we look.
Before I get to Pat, Amy, did you enjoy it? Did you actually forget about the sexualization of this, but did you mm-hmm. like, as a writer, did you like being on television?
At first, you know, because I was really green and I had no experience and they just threw me up there, I wanted to vomit every single time, and it was terrifying. But eventually, you know, Bruce is right, and I've heard this from countless people. I'd imagine Pat will say the same thing. When you're on television, it's amazing how differently players, coaches, et cetera, will treat you. I mean, there are players. I'd walk into a clubhouse one day, and they'd come up to me and start talking to me like we had ever even had a conversation before, you know, that we were really tight. And I hadn't even talked to that player ever before. It's like he knew me because he had seen me on TV, and it does lend certainly, I think, an added credibility. Perhaps, you know, maybe that's not entirely justified, but people see you on TV, and apparently they think you're important. And I will say, and I will also agree with Bruce, that it is seductive in a lot of ways, and I really enjoyed it, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to actually go to SB Nation and do this YouTube stuff, because I'm going to be doing even a lot more stuff in front of the camera. So I had, for the most part, positive experiences being on camera, and I definitely enjoyed it.
All right, Pat, television-wise, for ESPN, you did from ESPN news hits to post-college football game hits to First Take. I mean, you were all over the place, and I will give you credit here, because I think everybody on this podcast knows how I feel about Skip Bayless and that show. And to Pat's credit, he defended Bayless as someone who really did his work and prepares. And I respect Pat's take on that. I still feel how I feel about Skip, but I certainly respect that. Even if I disagree with how he's doing it, it seems, if nothing else, the research is there. But Pat, so you've had experience on television in all different forms and all different kinds of shows. How now at Yahoo, you're dramatically going to be decreased when it comes to your television presence. So you can play off what Bruce said about TV, but I'd like you specifically to also talk about the fact that your presence, at least nationally, that's one of the trade-offs with ESPN. Your television presence nationally is going to drop significantly.
Yeah, it is. And that's, you know what, I'm fine with that trade-off. I think Yahoo's fine with that trade-off. I never got into the business to do TV, just like Bruce and Amy said. It just kind of happened. And there's absolutely no doubt that there were benefits in terms of recognition. Players, I think, maybe even more than coaches. And that, you know, they may, maybe some of that will be lost, but, that means you, I guess, have to work harder in terms of building relationships that where people aren't going to see you on TV. I that's never why I got into it. I never saw myself as a TV guy. And I was, I was a bit of a tweener in TV, I thought, anyway, where some people saw me as a quote-unquote analyst or opinion guy, and some people saw me as a quote-unquote information guy. The College Football Game Day, which is a great show, and I love being on that, but they wanted me as an information guy. First Take wanted me as an opinion analyst guy. And so you're kind of walking both sides of that fence. And someone, as Bruce said, that the amount of time consumed by doing TV and the fact that I said yes to everything, which was kind of my credo, is that in my entire career is they won't fire you if you keep doing what they ask you to do. And so just keep saying yes to everything. As I said yes to too much TV, and it kept me from writing very many good stories, I thought. Everything kind of boiled down to the 40-yard dash in a game and 16 TV hits a week. And I thought that, where were the good stories actually in there? They were kind of disappearing or growing fewer in number, and I think I'll have an opportunity to do more of those with Yahoo.
Pat, did you find that, and if it's not the case, it's not the case, but did you find that opinion makers were valued more highly at ESPN than information brokers, meaning like the Baylesses and the Merrill Hodges and the people who can maybe create water cooler conversation, more valued than John Clayton coming on and giving you some transaction from the Browns? Or would that depend on each individual producer and/or department?
Yeah, I think it depended on producer, department, show, nature of the news cycle, what was going on. They do really like it when they can put somebody out there, whether it's on ESPN News or SportsCenter or whatever, when they say, "Give us the very latest," and you actually have the latest. I mean, you've got some information, as opposed to giving back channel analysis after the news has already happened. But they do like those instant analysis things. I don't know how many times I sat in a chair and they would, you'd finish a SportsCenter hit and they'd say, okay, now give us 45-second instant analysis that we can use, for the overnight SportsCenter. And you'd have to just sit there and crank something off the top of your head that was more opinion-based or whatever. So there's definitely a market for both. You're right about the volume and, cartoonish nature of some of what they want from people. I like doing First Take with Skip, but I wasn't going to interrupt and scream and pound the desk as much as some other guys that were on there more often. If that's what they wanted, fine. I can understand. It probably works with the viewers. It didn't necessarily work with me.
Bruce, I want to ask you, and Pat and Amy can certainly weigh in if they want, about sourcing. This is something I know that's really important to you and something that you wanted to discuss. How transparent, how accurate do you believe ESPN is when it comes to crediting other news organizations on stories?
I think they're really inconsistent with it, and it's kind of being on the outside. And I'd always heard this when I worked there, and I worked there a long time, from some of my friends who were at different places. And, I saw evidence of it. And then to be on the other side of it, I see how frustrating it is. I mean, the first, big story I felt like I had this about a month or two ago was Arizona fired Mike Stoops, its football coach. And somebody I know there said I was all set to retweet it. And then I was like, man, if I retweet that, I'll get fired. And that aspect of it where they can't acknowledge it unless somebody at ESPN's fingerprints are on it, is frustrating.
You think that's retweeting you getting, or is it you, Bruce Feldman specific, or just retweeting the fact that it was from another organization?
No, I actually think it's that in general.
Okay.
I don't think, you know, obviously I'm not, you know, there was an ESPN party at the National Football Foundation event last night. I wasn't going into it, you know. I know I'm in a different spot right now, but I think that's in general, because that's just the operation. And if you ever see any story, and I can't speak to it in baseball, I can't speak to it as much in NBA or those other sports. I mean, I follow them, but I'm not like, you know, I don't know who's out there first or anything like that. I know it with college football, and you know, and I've followed enough with the Jay Glazer kind of stuff, you know, where he called it out. I know, and this is before, when I was still at ESPN, but you know, something as simple as you have a story and then all of a sudden it doesn't exist. And then all of a sudden you're watching SportsCenter and it pops up on the ticker as sources. Every once in a while, they will accredit a report to somewhere. I'm not saying necessarily AP, but they'll say, you know, report in the Chicago Tribune or wherever. But it's very haphazard how they do it. And I know I've talked to people who work there who say they believe that this is, that they will sometimes not acknowledge a story because until it gets announced by the school, rather than, you know, it's almost like, to, you know, out of spite or something. I mean, look, you know, I worked there for a long time. A lot of those people I worked with, they knew I wasn't throwing crap out. I mean, I would be cautious more than just throw anything or attach my name to it. I never was that guy. So they know it, and I'm not saying that they have to believe everything I write, but a lot of those people follow me, you know? So it's a frustrating dynamic, and again, I'm saying it as somebody who used to work at ESPN, and I'm sure that there was a lot of times where, you know, when you're the ESPN guy, it's embarrassing for you when your company kind of operates that way. I have friends who are still there, and some of them have a lot more pull than others. But they, you know, some of them will acknowledge it online. Some of them are scared to death to acknowledge anybody else online. And, you know, I think it's embarrassing for a lot of those people who, you know, there's a ton of really talented and really hardworking people at ESPN. And they're people I have a ton of respect for, there. And I think sometimes that it's unfortunate that they get painted with that brush because of how they treat things when it comes to the breaking news stuff.
I'll open this up to Pat and Amy. You guys don't have to comment. The one thing I would say to you, Pat, is you can't speak for Yahoo, but I can tell you that knowing a ton of your colleagues and having talked to them many times over the years, their biggest complaint might be the fact that many of their beat people have complained, I will be specific here, complained specifically to me that they have not been credited for stories that they've broken first on ESPN. And a lot of times their perception is that, you know, ESPN will, at once the story's out there, will flood the zone and then try to control the story based on, like, the number of troops they have there and sort of the breadth of coverage that they can do. You overwhelm the story enough, and then the viewer believes it's your story. Do you want to follow up on sort of what Bruce said when it came to sort of sourcing now that you're on the other side?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I've heard the same complaints, you know, from a lot of different people about that. My experience, you know, I was kind of so far removed from the decision-making process of how news stories got put together or what got put on the crawl that I don't really know, you know, how those things happened or what sort of decisions were made in that case. I just, you know, my only feeling was that ESPN didn't break as much news as it should have given the resources it had available.
Amy, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have an opinion on this. I think I worked pretty closely with the news desk, you know, particularly over the last 4 to 5 years, once I moved from ESPN the magazine to .com. And I think, I mean, just like Pat and Bruce, obviously, I think if you work at ESPN, you hear it from everyone in the industry. And you also hear it from fans, by the way. There are a lot of fans who actually are aware and acknowledge and sometimes even tell or write to you about how ESPN just, you know, steals other people's reports and slaps, you know, someone's name on it and pretends to claim scoop of its own. And so that's nothing new. You know, I think sometimes, out of fairness to some, a lot of those people who work really hard on the news desk, and a lot of them I have a tremendous amount of respect for, sometimes they really don't even know. I mean, there could be, and I think it really depends on the type of news we're talking about as well. If there's like a player transaction, I just flew back from the baseball winter meetings in Dallas this morning, at 5:15 a.m. by the way. So if I'm not coherent on this podcast at all, that's my built-in excuse. But there are all these rumors going around. Scoops are like last for 0.02 seconds. And so a lot of times the people on the desk who I believe for the most part are making these decisions, I can't fully speak to that because I don't know exactly the hierarchy and the infrastructure completely there, but they don't even know that, you know, Ken Rosenthal just reported, you know, that Prince Fielder signed because 2 minutes later there's an email from Buster in the inbox saying, you know, sources say Prince Fielder signed, and we tag it and it's on, you know, the bottom line and out it goes, and everyone in the industry is pissed because it seems that ESPN is trying to claim its own scoop when in fact, you know, another reporter actually first had it. And so I think it's really hard sometimes to fully know exactly how the process is working and how people are informed. But I will say that in the same token, I also know that sometimes there's a process that exists where if they happen to see something, they'll reach out to an analyst, you know, a sports, I can't speak specifically to the other sports, but I'm sure this happens, where they'll reach out to some of, you know, the news gatherers and the newsbreakers in a given sport and say, hey, do you know anything about this? You know, what do you got on this? And then how those decisions are made, you know, to credit and not credit, you know, I can't fully speak to that. But I think it is a little bit more nuanced than maybe people from the outside realize. And also, it happened to me a ton of times too, where newspapers and other outlets wouldn't credit me when I had something completely exclusive, that they hadn't even sniffed. But I will say, for the most part, ESPN, I think, is pretty, somehow over the years has developed a reputation of really trying to sort of dominate that landscape and claiming scoops when maybe it's not always, you know, they're people who have the first scoop.
And I think
just jump in on that. I 100% agree with what Amy was saying in terms of, I think the desk is somewhat at the mercy of a news cycle that's so fast right now you can't really keep up with who's breaking what.
Right.
And, right now a scoop maybe lasts 5 minutes. If you got something, you know, like a Miami story like Charles Robinson broke, it'll last longer, but there's not much else that will. And I think it's just very difficult to give appropriate credit for any news desk trying to ferret that stuff out.
And Amy made a fair point, I should say, that there's no doubt that some of ESPN's work and scoops have certainly been not attributed in other places. It does work both ways, and you have to be fair on that. Pat, what story do you want to most report or write in the next calendar year, and is it a story you could have done at ESPN?
It's a good question. I think that the big picture stories in college sports right now, to me, Rich, are, you know, first of all, how did the landscape get this way with the conference realignment and everything else going on and the scandal cycle, and just kind of examine, you know, what part of the machinery of college sports is so broken that we've gotten to this point. And the other part is just the nature or culture, I guess, that leads to the sort of things that have happened at Penn State and allegedly at Syracuse and what's gone into that. Those, you know, bigger picture kind of broader view things and where the culture of college sports may be culpable in that or maybe not. I don't know, but I'd like to find out. And would I be able to do this? I don't know. I mean, maybe. It depends, you know, whether I could convince an editor that it was necessary and I could get time to do it. And as I said, one of the great things about Yahoo is there's a whole lot of two-way communication and two-way decision-making. And I think that, you know, if I go to my editors and say, here's what I'd like to do, there's a very good chance they're going to say, okay, go ahead and do it, as opposed to, you know, maybe months of deliberation and not hearing and not knowing what anybody's thinking, and then you come back, get back a yay or nay sometime later.
Amy, same question.
I'm not telling you. Are you crazy? You know what? I'm in such a weird creative space right now with what we're trying to do at SB Nation. I think we've got a big challenge ahead of us, and I think really, and not to like give you a really boring, vague answer, but I'm the story or the stories that I most want to report and write are the ones that no one else is really doing. I just shot a feature and I'm writing a print story that hopefully will run within the next week or so, on a story that I know no one else had done. It's off the beaten path. It's not, you know, it's none of the major sports. I mean, those are some of the stories I'm most looking forward to exploring, that maybe I didn't always have the freedom or the time or the ability to do so when I was at ESPN. And I'm sorry if that's a really lame answer.
No, that's fine. Bruce, I'll eventually get to this with you, but I want to ask you, a couple of questions sort of based on your story when it gets to being the subject of the sports media, which you've had to experience far more than any of us so far in our careers have had. One, how did you think the coverage of your story was? And two, in general, what do you think of media, either reporting on media or media? You know, I'll ask a specific question. There were a ton of people who came out, as you know, in support of you, including colleagues in my place, Andy Staples, Stuart Mandel. People at ESPN joke that they call me part of the Bruce Feldman cartel, which is interesting.
Who are these people who joke that?
I'll be kind and not sort of sell them out on this podcast. But what by saying that, that's a very interesting sentence to even say to me. So you are in a unique situation in that certainly on this call, none of us have ever experienced being the subject of multiple New York Times stories, multiple things. So how did you come out on the other side? Where are you right now, and where do you stand on just the idea of media talking about you, defending you, being in the spotlight? It's not the best question, but I think you know where I'm getting at.
Yeah. You know, first, I got to say that I was really fortunate that when I was in the process of knowing I had to leave ESPN just for my own peace of mind, you know, I was grateful that CBS was there with a great opportunity, and they've been awesome to work with. And so that part's been great. But, you know, the whole aspect of it, it's so surreal and it's so overwhelming. There are times when I still think about it, you know, it just comes up. And when I started to go to events and do things, I had never been like, Pat was a columnist before. I wasn't. So I was strictly a reporter. So to go somewhere and be somewhere where you are the story and engage in it was a little unique for me at that part. And I think it'd be unique, honestly, for anybody after to the level it got, you know, at that time in July. But, you know, it was really different for me. And so I would go to, you know, a college campus and players who I wouldn't think would know me would, you know, yell out "Free Bruce" or something. And the recognition factor, there would be guys on a football staff who I'd never met before would, you know, come up and start talking to me. And it was very bizarre. And then, you know, as the season started, I remember the first event I covered the West Virginia LSU game. I'd spent a week in West Virginia for a story, and I was out at a bar and there were guys coming up to me saying, you know, I sent ESPN a letter and I told them to go f*** themselves. Cause you know, it was like, it's just a jolt to hear some of that, you know, when people are saying, cause I don't know any of these people. Now I'm thankful. Some of the people who came out, you know, and supported me on Twitter, they knew enough of the circumstances of what was behind it. Now they weren't on the conference call that, you know, still to this day boggles my mind. They didn't know the specifics of that, but they knew a lot of the specifics of the actual case and they knew, the details of that, but just that part of it. And then, you know, I got a call maybe 36 hours after it had gotten blown out. And this is, Richard Sandomir in the New York Times has done a lengthy story on it. And I'm on the phone with somebody high up at ESPN or relatively high up at ESPN. And this person doesn't even know what's in the New York Times. He just thinks it's on the blogosphere. And I'm like, have you seen the New York Times? No. And then they're asking where I, you know, if I've been talking to bloggers. And I wasn't talking to anybody at that point. And the only people I really would talk to is my family and two guys who were guys I grew up with who are not in the media. Because I felt like I could, you know, not that I couldn't trust other people, but you just don't want people, you know, saying anything, hey, I talked to him and he's feeling this way or whatever. So I just, you know, was trying to lay low as best I could. And that whole aspect of it, that went on for a while. And, you know, what really bothered me a lot when I came out of it was I would go somewhere and there would be somebody I know in the media, whether it was somebody I was a good friend with or somebody I'd just known for a while. And they would say, yeah, I, so-and-so from ESPN talked to me. They were like, well, they really, you know, there's more to the story. I was like, no, what is their claim? I would love to hear somebody from there say, you know, exactly what they think, you know, where the ball was dropped on my side. Cause there isn't, you know, everybody knew about it. And that still pisses me off. And it pisses me off that, you know, there's been guys I'm friends with who still work up there. And, you know, one of them who I, you know, I respect a lot was telling me what he had heard from somebody who was like a mid-level manager who was not involved in all, but he was like, but on that side of it. And it made me end up telling that guy what really happened just because I said, listen, that guy doesn't know. And if he thinks he knows, he's telling you, he's full of shit. And that stuff really, really pissed me off. And honestly, it still pisses me off, as you can tell.
Yeah.
And so to be part of the story, to have, you know, tell my sister, the way she found out was from somebody came in and said, your brother's in the New York Times. And so she bought three copies of it and found out that way. And I had to explain it. And all that time, I felt like ESPN is going to fix this mess they made. Somebody high up, some adult is going to come in and fix the mess they made. And instead, it just became a bigger and bigger mess. And, you know, my wife does crisis communications for a living. One of the things she pointed out to me was when a company has a big problem, you know, if they get caught in something, the biggest mistake they made is they end up thinking they can spin their way out of it. And all it did was it made it messier. And I know, you know, you've jousted with some of their PR people and some of the things they tweeted. It was just like, seriously, if the truth is not on your side, say less, not more. And, so it was an eye-opening experience. And when I went back to Bristol the next week, you know, a couple of the people who were on that call, one of them was like, he was very fascinated by the process of one of our own has become a story like this.
Right.
And they didn't really know how to handle it. And I keep coming back to it. So whenever somebody, I was like, it doesn't need to be that way. You can't be petty and paranoid. You know, and those things, because if you are that way, especially if you're not the underdog, you're the big place. And until you have that recognition factor and you can say, hey, we f***ed up, you know, then that's the first step. You don't start dancing. And I see it now. I totally see where, you know, you see other things out there and I see it from what I've been through and I see other stories from what I've been through. I'm a lot more skeptical of people in power. I'm a lot more skeptical of what people high up will do if their backs are against the wall. You find out a lot about people.
Pat and Amy, it's a very meta question because Bruce is on the line, but I think it'd be really interesting for people listening just to get your viewpoint on how you saw what went down with Bruce, because one, you guys were both working there when that happened, and two, I know you both respect Bruce, but yet publicly, there is no way you guys could have come out in support of Bruce at that time, for sure. And either one of you guys can take it.
I'll go ahead. That was really difficult. It was certainly much more difficult for Bruce, but I am a very good friend of Bruce's. Really loved working with him, and I remember. When the excerpts were coming out, and I sent Bruce an email and said, hey, you know, this is great stuff. What's the reaction been from Bristol? And, you know, I said the reaction was okay. And then it was like a couple of days later, the reaction was not okay, obviously. And I didn't really know what happened. And I totally respected Bruce's space and tried to, you know, not bother him because I knew he couldn't talk about it or anything. But, you know, we're stuck in no man's land, basically. You know, you're not going to come out and say anything on Twitter in support of him because you know how that's going to be received. And you're not going to come out and say anything in support of ESPN. And you just didn't want to have any part to anything to do with it. And,
And that's got to be frustrating.
Situation.
I was going to say, Pat, someone like you who's very opinionated, that had to be incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, you know, and there's all these people on Twitter saying, you know, well, you're throwing your friend under the bus. You're not coming to the defense of your colleague and everything. And I sent Bruce an email at one point. I just said, hey, you know, I hope you're doing well. I hope you come out of this okay. I hope you understand. I can't say anything on Twitter.
Hey, can I jump in quick?
I figured I needed to at least do that. And then I'll just sit back and be quiet and let the thing take its course.
Let me jump in quick just on this one. There were so many people internally at ESPN who reached out to me that were great. A ton of them, obviously Pat did, and a lot of people I heard from either through Facebook or whatever. The weirdest part was when I started getting it on my cell phone, because at that point ESPN owned my cell phone, and there were a couple of people, some of them really good friends, but some of them just know through work, who were lighting the company up in like these profanity-laced things. And I wanted to say, hey, you might want to chill on this, because it's my phone. They can look, you know, they can look through everything here. You know, as great as it was to hear from that, I think one of the first people I actually heard, and I think it was like before the thing really blew up, was from, I shouldn't even say, I guess, was somebody who's high up on the TV side who I did not know, who's like, you know, one of their more prominent guys who I know just a little bit. He has my cell phone and just told me how he went to bat for me with one of the people who were on the conference call. And at this point, I didn't know how big a deal this was going to be. I mean, I knew it was a problem. I didn't know what was coming next. But there were a lot of people like that who, you know, at ESPN, who felt like, you know, they reached out, and I'm grateful for that. I knew I was going to be friends with these guys, and I, you know, wherever I went, whether it was Pat or whoever, you know, beyond my existence at ESPN or his existence at ESPN.
Rich, it's sort of like getting back to what I was talking about, almost like that paralysis. You know, I wanted to say something too, but in the same exact position, I think I sent you like a Facebook message.
Yeah, you were one of the Facebook people, which was, there was definitely a handful of Facebook people that, you know, it was nice to hear at the same point. It's like, this is so weird. This is happening. It's like, I can't believe this is really happening. And then you're seeing it in different ways. And, you know, one of the people who Amy and I worked with for a while, sent me, it actually made me laugh out loud, and the text came in, it just said, "You're like Ferris now." And I was like, it's really weird, but that was the best analogy I heard for it.
Who sang that, Matthew Broderick?
No, some very short, sarcastic, obnoxious coworker that Amy and I had in New York.
Let's see if I can figure that out. Amy, was there anything else you wanted to add on that? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Pat, if that was you too.
That's okay.
No. I mean, I think Pat pretty much, you know, put that whole sort of experience into perspective. You know, we're so used to being able to share our opinions and by the way, also support of our colleagues, whether they were ESPN colleagues or they're just colleagues, you know, at a different outlet. And, when something that public happens and, you know, I have tremendous amount of respect for Bruce and, have always respected him as a journalist and want to obviously give my support in some sort of measure. You can't. And, you know, but that's, I think, you know, that's just the byproduct of obviously, you know, working for your employer and not wanting to obviously, make it seem as though you're sort of saying anything, that would be even highly suspicious of anything that they would potentially do in that situation.
Pat, did you want to add something?
Just to the greater point of media covering media, and I don't mean to say that a large part of what you do, Rich, is misguided by any means, because I think you're one of the most responsible at it. But I guess I'm amazed and somewhat troubled by the amount of media coverage media gets. Maybe that's either dumb or hypocritical. You know, if we're going to be on Twitter and we're going to be on TV and everything else, I mean, I guess we're as public almost as athletes we cover, but it just doesn't seem like that's the way it should be. So you can tell me how and where I'm wrong on that. But,
well, yeah, and then Bruce is shaking his head in here. So this is the only thing I would say to that, Pat. I mean, I do understand that. And first, thanks for the compliment, by the way. You certainly didn't have to say that, but thank you. But, you know, the one thing I would say to that is, you know, I can make a very good argument that Chris Berman, Bob Costas, Dan Patrick, whoever you want to name, are more famous than half of the roster of any sport in this country. Maybe not the NBA because there's only 12, but I guarantee you put those guys like that in a public forum against a 52-man NFL roster, and, you know, you tell me who's going to be more recognized. So I think right, wrong, or indifferent, the media people are public figures, and two, they're really well-known public figures, and we now live in a culture which covers, I mean, if we're going to cover Rob Kardashian, I think, you know, I hate to say it, I think we're going to cover Scott Van Pelt, and that is not a knock on Scott Van Pelt comparing him to Rob Kardashian. But Bruce, you wanted to say something.
No, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, I think that just from being out there on, you know, on the TV side, and we're out there more, I think it's something that, you know, Amy's younger than Pat and I, and you know, maybe it's a different, you have a different approach. You know, Pat, when he said when he got into this, he wanted to write. And I think, you know, I'm a little younger than Pat, but not much younger. But I think when we got into this, you weren't part of the story. And I always said when I, you know, I was at ESPN Magazine for a while, and that was really my main job. And I always said I wanted to do stories that they would never put on the cover, that they would be so, you know, kind of, you know, I don't say dark, but just stories that weren't star profile kind of things. And you wanted to be anonymous. And then, but at the same time, somewhere along the way, and I don't think any of us are Chris Berman or any of us are, you know, that. And I know you're not just trying to say that, but I think that, you know, as our profiles get bigger and we all do this, you know, especially through Twitter and these kinds of things, I think it's a weird space that it's hard to embrace, you know, but you have to come to terms with it. And it's, just seeing it firsthand for me, you know, the only way I can explain it to people is, previously to this summer, the hardest thing I ever dealt with in my life was my dad dying when I was like 19. That's the second hardest thing now, just because of when your whole world turns upside down. And I think going through a lot of this stuff, you just end up with a different perspective. And I think we end up in a different perspective, even, you know, just, you know, being more visible through any other way than you were when you were just filing a story and maybe only the people in your community see it. Now everything gets online. I can read some columnist in the Seattle Times. I can read somebody in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Back then it was very insulated. I think all these things have made everybody, there's just a lot more connectivity to it.
Great. You buy that, Amy?
Yeah, well, we live in a first-person world right now. I mean, that's how it shifted. I remember having a conversation with one of my editors at ESPN The Magazine back in 2005, maybe 2006, and the conversation was about how much focus we were maybe going to shift to writing more of those first-person stories. That the generation coming up was much more accustomed and used to reading stories that were in first-person, and that's sort of the way journalism was going, and that's what Twitter is, in essence. I mean, for the most part, I mean, some journalists out there really just use it as basically almost their RSS feed, like here, you know, just like sending out links to their stories, and they don't really have or add any sort of personality or commentary whatsoever. But I would say, I don't know if you guys agree with me, but I would say, by and large, though, that's not the norm. You know, what we all do, how we sort of project ourselves and our opinions, and then also share whatever it is that we're working on or whatever interests us. That's how people are consuming us and our content, and that makes it an entirely different world. And then on top of it, we've all been on television, and then on top of that, we've all worked for the most powerful, most recognizable sports brand, certainly in this country. So it's a whole lot of different factors moving towards us, on the whole, becoming more of the story.
And one of the things, Bruce, and I'll let you add in here a second, is I'm sure everybody on this call will agree with me. One of the great, I think Twitter is fantastic. It's an incredible, news feed. It's really a sort of historically game changing medium. But one of the things that it does reveal, especially among media, is it reveals character, narcissism, and personality. And so it really does speak to what Amy says. I have learned more about media members that I would have had no clue of just from reading their stories, from reading their Twitter feed. And I think that's good, because I think it's revealing. And even those people on Twitter who I find insufferable in the media and drive me crazy, there's something good, I think, as a reader, that I've learned a little something about them.
Yeah, I go back to this, what I was trying to say before a little bit, and I think Amy, you know, picked up on it, which was, you know, the lines are blurred a lot more now. And I think that sometimes you'll see somebody go, well, is this guy a columnist? I thought he was just a reporter. What is he, you know, a columnist? And Pat, I think, works with, you know, the guy who I think is the best at not straddling both, but doing both, because he's versatile, which is Dan Wetzel. He is a columnist, but he is also, you know, he is a terrific reporter. And I think sometimes when you see somebody's personality on there, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, he's, you know, when you're talking about Chris Berman or these people who are very celebrities or whatever, but I think there is an identifiable, you know, a quality that people have, and suddenly you buy into him, you subscribe to, you know, you don't agree with what everything he's saying, maybe on Twitter or whatever, but I think that you're able to reveal, so much more is revealed about the person behind the keyboard now that you never got that before. And you know, in that regard, I just think it's something that you really have to embrace, because if you don't, I just think you're missing out. But if you don't embrace it, I think that you may be even doing the reader a disservice.
Well, it does get into bigger questions of objectivity and the fact that maybe it just really is impossible. If nothing, you know, the people on Twitter comment on stories on a daily basis, and, you know, you really are accountable and transparent to the reader once you have a take on a story. That the people that I really respect are those who are actually reporting on the ground. Very easy to sort of comment and be a, you know, to sort of just like throw basically an opinion out there. It's much harder to actually do the legwork and the reporting and then have an informed opinion. You know, Pat, you're someone who I think straddles that line too, like Bruce said. I'm not sure you push your opinion as much as someone like a Wetzel does, but you do that. And listen, probably more than any of us, you've had to take a lot of gruff from college basketball fans around the country. If I knock ESPN or Fox or something like that, I may have a couple people saying, "Ah, you stink." But if you write about a certain team, man, I see on Twitter your app mentions, you really get it.
Oh yeah, sure. You know, that's I've always said that's an occupational hazard, and you know, that just comes with the territory. And it is interesting now on Twitter, you know, how much more immediate that feedback is. You know, there's no such, there used to be letters to the editor, and then they'd put your phone number underneath your column, you know, and people could call in, and then it's emails, and now it's just, you know, blam, as soon as your story hits, here comes the Twitter firing back at you, or the reader comments under the story or whatever. And, you know, that, I've always, you know, I've been writing columns since 92. I've never been short on opinions, and if you're going to have opinions, people are going to disagree with them. So that's kind of the nature of it. You know, the thing that I guess, I don't know, that mystifies me or aggravates me or whatever, is that now every opinion is certainly part of some deep agenda. You know, it's like, oh, well, you're in bed with the SEC because you think LSU and Alabama are the two best teams.
Right.
What if I actually just think LSU and Alabama are the two best teams? You know, I mean, that may be all there is to it. But now it's like everybody, and I think that there's a crisis in confidence in the media, and we've obviously played into it, whether it's the way we've done our job or not being able to explain the way we do our jobs. But there's a large segment of America out there that is quite convinced that most media-driven stuff can't be trusted because of the agenda behind it. And, you know, I sometimes struggle to come up with ways to combat it, but I think it's really hurt our credibility.
I think that's interesting, and there's no doubt that even, as Bruce sort of pointed out, media on media. Jason Whitlock, not too long ago, called me Tariq Aziz because of my column with Mark Schwartz, and then literally every other day I'm getting killed for being an ESPN basher because I've been pretty clear on Craig James. So if on the one hand I'm being called Tariq Aziz and on the other hand I'm being called a Craig James basher, I feel like maybe I'm actually doing my job if people think I'm in the middle. All right, we'll finish up with this. We're a little over an hour now, and we'll come to the conclusion of the conversation. Obviously, we can do this for many more hours, but I'll give you guys a break. Amy, starting with you, do you think there's anyone who could become a competitor to ESPN? And if so, whom? Or maybe that's not even a question we should be thinking about or asking.
Well, I'm sure that they are constantly thinking about that. I know a lot of people have speculated whether Comcast, NBC could eventually sort of make a push in that direction. You know, speaking personally from my perspective and working, just starting to go to work with SB Nation, which is a startup, by the way, in which a lot of people thought I was on drugs when I told them I was leaving ESPN for a startup. But what we're trying to do is actually sort of be the anti-ESPN and do things in a different way with a lot more freedom, a lot more creative freedom, and sort of build this online television network by doing really creative, different types of storytelling. And so it's interesting that you ask that question, because I'm sort of in the position right now, and my mindset has been for the last 3 to 4 weeks of how can we do it actually kind of polar opposite to them. And it's not as if an online television network is going to ever challenge ESPN, but it's just sort of the mentality in which we've had. But I most frequently, I don't know what Bruce and Pat think about this, but the one challenger, if you know, potential threat that I've heard mentioned sometimes is that Comcast-NBC combination.
It's possible. Pat, you can certainly follow up on that. But the thing I also wanted to ask you, in terms of a mind shift, when you're now out reporting, Pat, do you now think of ESPN as a competitor that you want to beat? I mean, or is that still going to take a little bit more time? But I wonder, just in your reporting, and obviously, listen, you're going to report the story. You're a really good columnist. You're going to do what you're going to do, whoever you work for. But I wonder if it's now implicit in your mind now that they're your competitor. You want to beat them on stories now. After having worked there for a long time.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I like the vast majority of the people that I came in contact with there, I really like and will like forever. And when I see Gene Wojciechowski or Ivan Mazel or Mark Schlabaugh at a game or Andy Katz or Dana O'Neill or whoever, I'm happy to see them. But by God, I want to write a better story than they do, and I want to do it better. And there's no doubt about it. When I can tell you this, when I got to State College that Monday morning and sitting at that Harrisburg Attorney General thing, and I look around, there's nobody there from ESPN, I'm saying, hell yes, because I'm here and you're not. And then I'm going to State College later that day, and I'm saying, hell yes, because I'm here and you're not. And so, you know, from that standpoint, you do want to do better than ESPN, and they are, you know, the quote-unquote worldwide leader in sports. But as I've said, Yahoo can try to be the worldwide leader in sports journalism, and so that's part of my job, is to try to beat ESPN.
And I would advise those who are listening, if you didn't read Pat's column after the Jim Boeheim's press conference, I think that was the second one, really unbelievably brilliant piece of work, and got the great detail of Julie Boeheim trying to cut the press conference short. I must have read 75 stories. It's the only place I read that. Very, very good little bit of detail, which is hugely revealing. All right, Bruce, you know, I'll ask you this question, but for you, it's totally different because, I mean, do you now, when you're working on stories, do you want to go out there and, like, is it Lou Holtz? These idiots just made a 50-year mistake and you want to beat them on every story? What's it like for you?
No, I mean, honestly, for me, CBS made a really big commitment to me. And so I want to reward that. And I feel the pressure to break, you know, every coaching hire or fire kind of thing. But, you know, Pat's right. I mean, Yahoo's track record in the last 5 years or whatever, 4 years, they staked a claim to investigative journalism that is unsurpassed at this point. And at CBS, you know, they made some really smart hires in the last year. And they brought Jeff Goodman, who's a really good news guy for college basketball.
Brett McMurphy,
who's killed it on all the conference realignment and stuff. And, you know, I know they just hired John Heyman, who used to work here, who's a baseball writer,
yep,
who breaks a lot of stuff.
Definitely.
So, you know, they've made a concerted effort. They want to, you know, be the leader and be the place you go for breaking news across all sports. And to be part of that is really fulfilling and everything. But, you know, I just want to do good work. At the same time, you know, you don't want to be so consumed with somebody else who's not you, you know, whether, you know, Pat mentioned some of those guys, you know, Mark Schlabaugh has always been a good friend, and Ivan and Gene, I've known those guys for years, and the bloggers they have. I mean, Ted Miller is one of my favorite people at ESPN. And so, you know, it's weird. You don't think there's the put the horns on the face of any of those people or anything like that. You just want to do it for the people who hired you because they wanted you. And I think that's really, you know, it's definitely what's driving me. I don't want to speak for everybody else, obviously, but I just feel like because they all three of us, I feel like left to go somewhere because we felt like we had a great opportunity, you know. And I know I've had conversations with Amy, you know, going back, you know, a year or two ago about different stuff. And so I think it's been great just to see them flourishing and to get that opportunity. And for me, it's been good. You know, sometimes, you know, you just got to remember, like it's, what are we doing here? You know, it's like, it's about the work. It's not about, you know, some big monolith or anything like that.
Last one for you, Bruce, and then I'll, if anybody else wants to add something in conclusion.
Rich, I did want to say one thing. Can I just spin off that for a second?
You can, Amy.
Okay, thank you.
As long as it's interesting and is entertaining and informative to this audience.
Okay, yes, I know Bruce, I don't know how old you were when you started the company, Bruce, but I know you were there for 17 years. So, I was in a little bit of a different position because I will say this, and you might edit this out, Rich, because
we're not editing anything.
It's not particularly salacious or controversial, but you know, I went into ESPN, you know, having only worked in the field for 4 or 5 years, mostly through wire services and freelancing, and that ESPN allowed me to build a name and, like what Bruce was talking about earlier, a brand, and gave me incredible opportunity and put me on TV when I had no business being on television. And for as much bashing as the company gets, and for me, and probably why I'm the least interesting person on this podcast, because I certainly didn't leave with any sort of rancor. I left on great terms, and I was extremely appreciative of everything that they did for me there. You know, I think I also sort of feel the same way as Bruce and Pat do, is that more than anything, it's really nice to be wanted by someone else and feel that you're valued, and you want to absolutely reward that employer, those people who said, all right, we're going to bet on you. We're betting on you, and we're putting you in this position, and it's high profile, and we want you to succeed and thrive, and you're going to have probably a lot more freedom, potentially, and potentially even some more creativity to do it. And so, I mean, for me, that's, I think, more than anything, the position that I sort of come from today, and that's definitely, like, not nearly as interesting.
No, it is. It's well said, and there's no doubt that, I mean, ESPN has done some amazing things for amazing careers and have sent them into great orbits. Bruce, I have one last one for you, and then I'll open it up if you guys want to end with this. And it just, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this because it does get asked to me a number of times. You now have to cover Mike Leach at Washington State. You are obviously the author of his book. And the question I get asked a lot is, well, how does Bruce Feldman now cover Mike Leach? Can he cover him objectively? What does he do with that? Does he... you know, is it just okay, and is it enough just to put something at the bottom that says Bruce Feldman is the author? So I think this is a fair question to ask. How objective can you be with Mike, and how do you cover a guy that you co-authored a book with?
Yeah, it's definitely a fair question. And, you know, I about a couple of weeks ago, I had emailed my bosses at CBS and said, listen, you know, Leach is going to get a head coaching job very soon. How do you want me to handle it? Do you want me to break it just like regular news? B, do you want me to just farm it to somebody on the desk? Or C, do you want me to basically pass along to another writer on staff? And they said, no, we want you to break it. And so when I did, you know, I put in the disclaimer and tried to be upfront with people saying, yes, you know, I wrote Swing Your Sword with Leach. And that was, you know, even when I did SportsCenter, when Leach was, being investigated at the end of his time at Texas Tech, I made a clear distinction for them that I am doing a book with Mike Leach, not about Mike Leach. And there's a big difference there. And obviously a lot of people, you know, get that. And so I wanted to be as upfront as I could. You know, going forward though, I am not the only person who's ever written a book with a coach or whatever. You know, your baseball writers.
You're not even the only one on this podcast.
That's very true, Pat.
But you know, you have a great baseball writer, Tom Verducci.
With Tori, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a lot harder for you to be the MLB writer to not cover, you know, it's a smaller fishbowl or whatever. And there's a lot of people who do it. You know, ESPN has Adam Schefter, who did a book with Mike Shanahan.
Correct.
And I don't think that, and I'm not saying that he should be, there should be a bug on the screen every time a Redskins story comes up. You know, I hear both sides, and I've talked to Richard Sandomir. I saw your dialogue with him and people's dialogue about that subject. You know, I'm not the Washington State beat writer. And, you know, if Mike Leach his team ends up winning the Pac-12, then, you know, I'm going to end up, you know, talking about it. But, you know, as a whole, I don't think it's going to be a subject where people know about it going in. As long as they know it going on, I'm not going to ram, you know, Washington State coverage down the readers' throats, you know, in the next year or 2 years or whatever. It's a unique situation because you, in that platform, it is a book. And I know that ESPN has now created a rule. It was interesting to me. Not long after they created that rule, Jackie McMullen, who's a very well-respected NBA writer who did a book with Shaq and is obviously around the horn, they know they have her on talking about the book. And it's, you know, it's a tough spot for a company like that to say, oh, we're going to make a rule saying nobody can do a book with anybody. Like, I know, and Pat, I respect immensely, not just as he's a good friend, but I mean, you know, I'm not a college basketball guy. I'm a fan of it. But, you know, if Pat writes anything about Kentucky, well, he's the guy, you know, he's going to get smeared. Correct. And I think if you're hiring Pat Forty and he works for you, you're hiring the guy who's, you know, who's been an award-winning writer for 25 years, has a ton of sources and a really good perspective. You would hope that the readers are going to make their own determination on whether he writes individually something good or bad and not go, oh, Pat Forty, he just hates this guy, or Pat Forty's in bed with that guy.
Right.
And I'd like to think people would see that the same.
I agree with you. And the one thing I would say is that any edited both at a big places like ESPN and ours, you have, in fact, a freelancers coming in. I mean, Mike Lupica appears on New York radio every day of the week for ESPN Radio, is on the Sports Reporters, has written books before, writes a political column where he has political takes. So there's all these nebulous kind of things. I understand the rule that ESPN has, but I think it's going to be harder to enforce. And I'm always one who I would trust my writer who has credibility in the arena to write the book and still be able to report if I'm hiring and trusting that guy. Pat, given that Bruce referenced you, did you want to add something to that?
It can be, if you're going to write a book with somebody, you can hand certain people a tool to bash you over the head if they want to use it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be accurate. It doesn't have to be fair, but they can say, because he wrote this book with that guy, he has the ever-present agenda, you know, and that's the reason he writes anything that's critical of this guy, and that's the reason he writes anything nice about that guy, not whether either side deserves it or not. So that it is a risk that comes along with it, that it can and will be used against you.
And Amy, am I correct that you have not written a book with anyone at this point?
That is correct.
All right, we look forward to.
I'm the black sheep of the group.
You
apparently.
Are, nor have I. So it's two black sheep. All right, listen, we've done 77 minutes. I think we're going to wrap it up. Is there anything you guys wanted to add before exiting this podcast? Pat, Amy, Bruce, anyone?
I'll just to somewhat reiterate what's already been said. It was a good life at ESPN. Don't regret any of it. Very happy with the life now at Yahoo.
Good point. Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I basically said as much. And everyone keep a lookout for our SVD shooting channel launching on YouTube in a few months.
Thank you for plugging that. It's like CNBC. Bruce?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that people know that the way I left ESPN was not on the warmest terms. You know, I was there 17 years, and I really, by and large, I have a lot of respect for, you know, most of the people there. And, you know, it's like Pat just said, I don't regret any of it. I don't regret anything I did. So I'm happy I'm there, and I'm happy, you know, I respect the people I'm on there with, yourself included. And so, you know, I'm just grateful that we have this audience, and some of that has been due to ESPN. A lot of that has been due to ESPN, and I know we all worked our asses off, you know, to make that happen. But I'm grateful for that opportunity.
All right. Well, our guests today are three of the best in the business at what they do in the sports media. I will run down their titles again, give you their Twitter feeds again, and. And if you're listening to this, and if you stayed with us this long, seriously, God bless you. You are better, perhaps, than
why?
Most.
Why did you?
Other than our immediate family members. All right, Bruce Feldman is the CBSSports.com senior college football columnist. He also appears on the CBS Sports Network. Amy K. Nelson is now a senior correspondent for SB Nation. As she told you on this podcast, they're going to be launching a channel and doing a lot of stuff in the video space. Pat Forty is now Yahoo Sports' national college columnist. You can catch his work on Yahoo's excellent site. And as he said, next year I would anticipate him doing a lot of really interesting enterprise reporting. Guys, thank you very much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Maybe 6 months from now, we'll check back in with you and see how you're doing.
Thanks.
Sounds good, Rich. Thank you.